This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Greetings, Kiwis, Norte Americanos, and other citizens of the globe, and welcome to Politics, a podcast where a genial and overemployed New Zealand comic and an irascible and very underemployed American journalist just sort of talk about things to cope with the pain of living in Trump world. Unfortunately, my co-host, your good friend and mine, Tim Batt, has been carried away by a whirlwind of activity. Most of you know he not only tours for live shows and does this podcast, but he also co-hosts the Worst Idea of All Time podcast with Guy Montgomery. But on top of all that, he runs the Little Empire Podcast Network, and that's honestly just a ton for anybody to have on one plate. I'm going to do my best to try to pick up the slack here, and I'll need a little help. So joining us this week is my former boss and freelance writer and contributing editor for Opinion at U.S. News and World Report, Megan Carpentier. Megan, thank you for bailing us out and being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
Aw. So you're not going to berate me on the audio like you used to do during staff meetings and text and like Google Chat.
I never berated you. I just suggested you could be less stupid.
All right. So I'm going to need you to act like a check on that for me, because Tim usually is the even keeled and amiable one who's like, Jeb, you know, dial it back a little. So I figured since Tim isn't here and we're both part of the same sort of incestual or circle jerky media crew, we could start by talking about, there was a very good piece today by your good friend and my good friend, Jim Newell in Slate, about how Trump essentially fucked himself in the first 100 days. And I mean, I have like ample thoughts about this. Did you read it? Was that something you agreed with, or am I just hitting you with something entirely new?
I mean, I assumed he usually paid Russian hookers to do that, but you know, sure. I mean, I guess giving it to Paul Ryan makes more sense.
Okay, so for people who haven't seen it, basically Jim's contention was that, and I agree with it. And I thought it was just really well stated that Trump, because he had no real ideological commitment to the Republican Party, had way more latitude to get into office and immediately compromise the Democratic Party by compromising with them and offering them ways to cooperate with the Trump presidency and delegitimize the growing sense of we must resist. And instead, as Jim sort of lays out, what Trump did was that he said, all right, Paul Ryan, your legislative agenda is my legislative agenda. And he wedded himself to kind of like Republican orthodoxy in a way that held no appeal really for Democrats and made their job a lot easier when their base came to them and said, we don't want you to cooperate. We want you to resist. And there was nothing for them to really cooperate with.
Right. I actually think Jim has it right to a certain degree, but I don't think it's because Trump doesn't hew to the Republican ideology as much as he doesn't view the Republicans as his team. His team is Team Trump. And so to play on Team Trump, he has to get what he wants. And I think he just didn't care about the Democrats because they were the losers. Because, you know, if you lose a real estate deal, you lose. You know, you lose a, I don't know, football game or whatever he played at his military school, you lose. The thing is there's lots of ways in Washington to win by losing, as the Democrats have amply demonstrated. And the healthcare agenda is one of them. You know, once people started to realize that the Obamacare that they hated was the Affordable Care Act they actually sort of benefited from, which was something that the Republicans could allow not to happen when they were just saying no, but had no power. You know, the things really started to shift. It wasn't just Democratic voters that were for the Affordable Care Act. It was Republican voters and Trump voters and people in Kentucky who had one of the lowest insurance rates in the country before Obamacare. And now because they had a Democratic governor, because they had access to the Medicaid expansion. Now, there's a lot more people insured in the state of Kentucky who realize that while it's imperfect, it's better than being uninsured. As most people know, if you've ever been uninsured and had to pay for something out of pocket.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I liked what you said about like the point of Team Trump, because this is the thing that I was scared about during the general election. Was I thought he was going to win the nomination and then turn right around and tack hard to the center and go back to being kind of New York plutocrat Trump, who thinks universal health care is pretty good and, you know, would have just enough apostasy that he could yank Clinton voters away. And instead, he went hard right even more, seemingly, and repeating what he'd already said. And then he won anyway. And at that moment, you know, if you are a megalomaniac who might have been on the cusp of being less megalomaniacal, the fact that you just won and defeated all these odds or overcame all these odds would only reinforce the, you know, your commitment to just doing exactly what you want to do. But like that was, I mean, it still seems to be like that sort of Damocles, like at any minute he could just kind of go like, yeah, fuck the Republican Party. I want to get this thing done.
Yeah, I think he got the thing done that he wanted to get done, which was winning. He's now won. The difficulty is once you win, you have to govern. And how do you govern? You have to compromise. You have to have an agenda. That agenda has to be something you can put into law, which is, you know, much more complicated than a real estate deal that you can turn over to some lawyer to write once you've settled on the outlines of it. I mean, this is his thing, is he comes in to these, you know, complex policy debates with people who have been doing this on the Hill for years and years, and like, here's my plan, and like his, you know, his plan, his tax reform plan, which is something that Washington has been focused on for, you know, 15 years. And you've had Bill Thomas and Charlie Rangel and Kevin Brady and all these people try to fix it. But, you know, he's going to come in with a 2-page like thing of talking points. Like no one's ever thought of that in Washington before. And like, that's going to be his tax reform plan. And, you know, now go figure out the details, buddy. Like that's not how legislation works. It's not how Washington works. You know, I mean, if that's how it worked, Tom Donahue would be the most powerful man in Washington. Cause the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce can walk in with a 2-page bullet pointed thing on every issue he wants solved. But that isn't how it works.
Was it actually 2 pages? Because I remember the quote I read was that it was almost like 200 or 400 words total. I mean, it was like a third of a column. And then, and like, what was even more amazing is that it's regressed. But it's like, it's actually regressed in terms of sophistication from the tax plan he unveiled on the trail. Like, which was, you know, if you go and look at like his old campaign website, what he was actually saying a year ago was more detailed and more, I don't know, intellectually credible. I mean, mathematically it isn't, but like there was like at least the kind of glimmer of effort somewhere on the document in its original form. And then when he actually has the means to accomplish something, it was kind of like, well, fuck it, we'll bar napkin it, right?
Well, that's how you got the Laffer curve in the first place. If you don't know that story, which is what he's basing his whole plan on, is the idea that if you just cut taxes, revenue will just magically appear, and people will just automatically make more money, and you know, you won't have to account for the loss of tax revenue in the budget in any way. Which, you know, even Laffer thought that there was a point past which tax cuts would not have that effect. And there's some evidence that, you know, in the Bush years, we actually kind of got there. You know, what with it ending with a recession and all.
Well, well, like Laffer was arguing against, like, you know, quote unquote, like confiscatory, like 75% taxation. And like, I think it's really about like 45%. You can only reduce it so much before you get that diminishing return. But I mean, like his main objection was
very few people pay 45%. You know, I mean, that's the thing. You know, we talk about these tax rates as though that's valid, but those are the rates. Those aren't the actually actionable rates that people are paying.
Yeah. Like if you're a rich person and you were actually paying that number, you would have to have like some kind of claw hammer in the brain to just kind of like, oh, that number. OK, I'll apply that to. Well, here you go. Like you would have to be the sort of person who's like, hey, Paul Ryan's, we can do all our taxes on a postcard. That's going to work out for me.
Well, right. I mean, that's the thing. You can do all your taxes in your postcard unless you have, say, a kid and a mortgage and property taxes and medical expenses and all of these things that people take for granted. And this is the thing that I think Republicans have really taken for granted with tax reform for a long time, is people like discounts. You know, this is Macy's whole structure. You know, you go into a Macy's with your 20% off coupon, and this has happened to my mother. They used to just raise the prices 20% on coupon day. It used to drive my mother apeshit. Let me tell you, she still tells the story from 20 years ago when that happened to her. But, you know, people will, like Macy's found, and they tried to lower prices and just say, okay, we're always just going to charge you $30, which would be kind of one of our sale prices on this like series of items, and no one would buy them because the coupons weren't valid and there wasn't a sale, even if it was less than they would have paid on the sale, because people just like that discount thing. People like that on their taxes. You know, you could take less money out of everybody's paycheck every week or every other week or every month or whenever they get paid, to lower their tax rate, but and even lower their effective tax rate. But at the end of the year, if they didn't get their refund back because they don't have any credits and deductions, people would be mad about it. And Republicans kind of know that. Trump, I don't think, knows that, because he doesn't pay taxes like normal people and never has.
Mm-hmm. So like just a couple hours before this, the you know, American Health Care Act, the ACHR or whatever, died again. Because they had something like 20 Republicans who weren't going to commit, or 15 who most definitely were not going to vote for it. They could only lose 20, but then they had an additional 20 to 25 that were on the fence and leaning no. So that was going to be his capstone to the 100 days. And so instead of kind of like having a grand finale on the 100th day, it's another goose egg. Did you see this one coming, or like, and can he go back? Can they try and take a third bite at this apple, or do they have to figure out a way to sort of like subtly?
I mean, legislatively they can.
Yeah.
So legislatively they can take a third bite at this apple, because it wasn't actually defeated on the House floor. Paul Ryan pulled it, which gives him as Speaker the ability to bring it back and put it back on the agenda. I mean, they have to at some point do something, right? I mean, they can't have promised this for years and have to go into the 2018 election saying, you know, we never agreed amongst ourselves because we were just all kind of bullshitting you about it because we wanted to defeat Obama. But that's effectively what it is. And, you know, they're going to have to take away health care from people. They're going to have to charge women more for maternity care. But women are more than half of the electorate, you know, which some, you know, people on the Hill, I think, like to forget. So you can't start charging women more for health insurance because they can get pregnant again and expect women, you know, in Iowa not to notice. And you can't expect, you know, people with breast cancer in Nebraska not to notice that their, you know, premiums went up, you know, $60,000, or if you get tested and you have one of the breast cancer genes. You know, these are some sort of fundamental issues to a lot of people that they're just sort of the, you know, Freedom Caucus is running ideological roughshod over, and it's never going to get past the Senate. And you're going to keep peeling, you know, whichever way you go at this point, you're going to keep peeling people off. And quite frankly, like, you can find some CEOs that in private, like, admit they'd sort of maybe wouldn't mind universal health care, because then they don't have to pay for it, really. And they figure if everyone's paying for it in taxes, they'll actually end up paying a little bit less in taxes than they would for actually just buying their employees' health insurance. You know, the only constituency for getting rid of it now is people that either are ideologically opposed to having to force Americans to buy health insurance for whatever reason, and this sort of political imperative that they themselves created.
Just, I kind of want to roll it back for a second. So just for like our fans who are listening, who are primarily Tim fans and are not from the U.S., one of the things you mentioned about like maternity care. So one of the ways that they're trying to cut money is to say like, well, you can give insurance to people, but we're going to leave out, let's say, these 10 or 15 basics of care. And so one of the ones is that you can have health insurance, and let's, you know, you're a woman with health insurance, but it doesn't cover giving birth. So,
or prenatal care of any kind. Like, if you get pregnant, honey, you on your own.
Yeah. And so like what normally in every other sort of OECD nation is a really basic thing. You get pregnant and then you go into a doctor, and then that doctor stays with you for 9 months and the baby comes out, becomes this like I don't know, $100,000 bill. I remember looking at the bill for my son and just sort of blanching and putting it away because I knew that we were fortunate enough to have insurance that covered it. But I mean, just, you know, an overnight stay in the hospital, which a mom needs, that's not going to happen. And what are you going to do? You're going to sort of like give birth and, you know, like out in the alley or like wherever you happen to be. And just, you know, like, I hope I can make it home and I don't bleed out.
I mean, you think about it, every sonogram's $400 or $500. So if you have one a month just to make sure the baby's not dead, you know, amniocentesis will cost you a couple hundred dollars. You know, every time you go to the doctor's office, that's $200-$300.
If you get gestational diabetes and you suddenly have to take insulin or something akin to that, that's going to, yeah.
I mean, you have to have, you know, a C-section or else die. You know, are you going to like, I mean, you're not going to say, no, I don't have $30,000 to spend on that, but you'll be bankrupt like before your child's done breastfeeding. Yeah. I mean, these things are expensive. And to a certain degree, you know, people don't plan well. We don't tend to plan for contingencies. I don't think that's just an American thing, but I think it's definitely an American thing sort of like blown up. And when it comes to health insurance, I mean, look, if you'd have told me at 22, that I didn't have to pay $200 extra a month as long as I declined maternity coverage, I had to decline maternity coverage. Would I have remembered that when I was having sex? You know, that probably wouldn't have been top of mind for me. I mean, you know,
the next morning, sure.
I might have chosen to have safe sex. You know, I don't even share the next morning, depending on how good the night was. But, you know, those are not things that you're going to think about at certain ages. And yet, you know, for the party that wants to say, encourage women to have babies instead of abortions, you know, a little silly to kind of make that economic choice that a lot of American women already have to make about whether or not they can afford to carry a child to term and bring, you know, and then raise a child to adulthood, to make that an even starker economic choice in this day and age is you know, while taking away women's access to maternity care. Yeah, it's a hard decision, you know, and so much of this is just driven by this ideology that's divorced from practicality, you know,
I don't know about that. I mean, it's very practical. If you believe that women should be inherently subservient to men and you're paying them less per hour than you pay a man for the exact same job, and then you say, you know, you make maternity care a bankruptible, if you make being pregnant a bankruptible offense, then they're going to be very dependent on a man. Like, they're going to need that extra revenue. They're going to need somebody to support them so that they can have a house. You're not going to have as many single moms if it's a bankrupting act. I mean, there's a remarkable consistency in how you know, how sex can be punished if you're not a penist American. Like, I don't know. I do kind of admire, like, I kind of admire like the holistic contempt for women there. Like, I mean, there really is no stone left unturned in making women's lives shittier, like in that group. So I don't know. Like,
well, I think though, in a certain way, I agree with that. I think there is sort of a contempt for women and a contempt for women's place in the larger society outside of the home and the biological imperatives that women are sort of saddled with in a way that men are not. But I also think it just, you know, ideologically, it's not consistent. It is just these ideas that they're getting from, you know, think tanks and economics books that they haven't really understood, quite frankly, and without any practical application to the world. And I think if you look at the 2016 election, you know, the sort of practical ideas sort of came from Hillary Clinton, who wasn't popular amongst liberals for being too practical. And then you have the sort of completely impractical ideas of Donald Trump, like a wall across the whole border, like deporting 11 million, you know, Latinos in this country, like, you know, all of these things that he said he was going to do and said he would do in the first 100 days, which has turned out to be absolutely impossible for him. You know, all of this was just these grandiose schemes that were not practical in any way. And I think you're just sort of seeing where the rubber hits the road of ideology versus practicality. Those are hard things to square because so much, I think, of Republican ideology that's based in sort of capitalist economic theory is really based on a lot of like misunderstandings and deliberate illusions, like market failure. You know, market failure is kind of like a 101 kind of economic concept insofar as I learned it. And I'm not saying that I didn't learn it at, you know, universities, which I guess are all too liberal with the teaching. But, you know, these are some basic things. You know, Ayn Rand was not like an economist per se, but you have a lot of people that just sort of believe her philosophy as opposed to actual numbers.
Yeah, and she was still, like, she was taking Social Security and Medicare when she died, too, right? So, like, fucking hypocrite. Well,
I mean, yeah. Hypocrisy is another kind of interesting philosophy, but that one has a pretty good toehold in Washington, I think.
Well, I mean, like, sorry, like, I thought of something and I went, no, I can go nowhere with that. We've gone on for a bit and we should take a break, so I just want to leave, like, I want to leave everybody with two thoughts. One, Ayn Rand was buried, like, at her funeral, there was, like, a 6-foot, like, floral arrangement shaped like a dollar sign. And two, or B, I don't know if I started with A or one. I've forgotten. It's been a while. Trump promised all of these things on day one. So really, like, the last 99 days have been us kind of waiting around for an epilogue that was just going to be as disappointing as, you know, the introduction. Okay, and we're back. And Megan, Nerd Prom is coming up. Are you psyched for Nerd Prom?
Woo! You know, I went to 3 proms. I'm pretty chill about it. So, you know, it's every year.
So is the people?
Sorry, is that the least nerdy thing I've ever said in my life?
No, congrats on 3 proms. I didn't go to mine, but I had a friend who was a senior when I was in, like, community college, and she was like, can you please come with me? And I broke my not going to prom streak. And I really, yeah, I kind of feel like that mars my record. I could have just been like, no, I rejected it. But anyway, Nerd Prom, for people who are not from the United States, is the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and it's held every year. And you may remember Stephen Colbert roasting George W. Bush 20 feet away from him and making him sort of just force feeding him crow for about 20 minutes. And then, of course, Seth Meyers.
And the next year they had to have Rich Little. It was so bad.
Yeah. Rich Little, who, you know, does a really good Nixon and Reagan impression if you're 60.
Old.
Seth.
Probably more like 80 at this point.
Yeah, yeah. I met Rich Little. He didn't like me. It's a long story. We don't need to get to it here. So Nerd Prom, Seth Meyers did it in, I think, 2011 or 2013. It's been a while. When Obama was president and he needled Donald Trump, and supposedly that might have been the thing that pushed Donald Trump over the edge and made him run. And, like, maybe it was a McKay Coppins article. And there's always, like, some sort of weird urban legend about what made him do it. But that was really the last interesting one. And then this year.
No, Larry Wilmore. Larry Wilmore.
Okay. That's right. I do remember that. A little bit of.
I mean, I can't say what he said, but he said it was very funny.
Yes. Yes. He used a racial term.
You'll just have to look it up on the internet. You can do that while listening to a podcast. Just take our word for it. It was very funny.
Yeah, don't do it if you're driving. Like, pull over to the shoulder.
Yeah, maybe.
Or just yank the wheel into the median. That's fine. I mean, if it's a grassy median.
There's not a lot of mediums in places sometimes. So just pull over. Do it when you get to the office.
So you and I covered one. We weren't there. We got saddled with live blogging one. Which one was that? Was it anyone good?
Actually, technically, you volunteered, and then I got saddled because I had all of the, like, logins and crap. That was 2015. Yeah. I got saddled with it 2 years in a row because they liked it so much when I did it the first year, which was, like, deeply demoralizing and disheartening, that they made me do it again a second year, which was last year. And so basically I was just like, here's a pretty dress, and also here's something going on in the world that really matters. It was like 6 hours of that.
Right. So by now there's like a brunch, you know, you go to, you know, some sort of DC mover and shaker type. And I think, Arianna Huffington has some sort of, you know, some sort of morning or mid afternoon spa where you can go and smell boxed air or something. And then there's this you know, gala where people sit at round tables and it's mixes of media and politicians and then random celebrities who get invited. And there's a comedian and doing, you know, his bit, and then the president and his speechwriters have him do his bit. And then Trump is bailing on it this year. But I think you said you were doing some sort of coverage for it. What are you doing?
Well, so normally there's actually like a whole week of parties that are sponsored by like lobbyists and corporations, and they invite the media and they invite all the politicians. And it's like, it ends up being like sort of, it ends up being like you grew up in sort of a contiguous area with a bunch of high schools and you're really popular. So you have to go to everyone's prom. It's sort of like that, but with people that still think that's cool when they're in their 50s.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
But this year, Trump said in February that he was not going. His entire staff is, and this is a direct quote, standing in solidarity with the president. Because the media has been so mean to him, so mean, that they're not going either. And so, and then of course, there's people in the media who absolutely hate Donald Trump. So the New Yorker canceled their party, Vanity Fair, which is led by, which the editor of which is Graydon Carter, who said, who was the one that coined short finger vulgarian, bailed on their big party. Bloomberg ended their party. Time Magazine ended their party. People Magazine ended their party. So all of the big parties that are like must-have tickets are totally not happening. You know, the Washington Post was reporting this week that almost no celebrities are coming, so there will be no Kardashians in attendance this year. And I think it's funny that the sort of our celebrity president who was raised on reality TV, who himself has attended multiple times, he was there in 1993 at Graydon Carter's table for Vanity Fair, when Graydon Carter had to move the model that he'd invited and sat next to Donald Trump because the model came to him crying and complained about how vulgar he was. And that was sort of that sealed the deal for Graydon Carter on Donald Trump, actually, was the White House Correspondents' Dinner and what a nasty, brutish person he was. Little random facts. So
was his rudeness verbal, or was it, let's say, like handsy?
The article that I read by Graydon Carter was not specific. It seems that he felt it necessary to comment on the tits of every woman in the room, and give, when there's like, you know, thousands of women in the room, there's a lot of tits to comment on. So she probably just listened to 30 minutes of him talking about boobs and was like, you gotta be kidding me, I'm trying to eat. I mean, I could listen to 30 minutes of me talk about boobs, but I'm much more fun about it. I'm just not like, look at the tits on that one there. Look at the tits on that one over there. Like, you know, everyone's in formal wear. There's a lot of boobs in the room. That's how it works.
I feel like, and this is, maybe this is just me, like Trump seems like one of those guys who has like 50 or 60 different synonyms for boobs that like most men lose. Like if there are 50, most men lose like 45 of them by the time they can drive a car. But like he's still there going like, yeah, look at them cassabas. I love those yabos. Like, look, you know, look at them, I don't know, like milk something. Like milk jugs. Like
Bigly.
Yeah.
Bigly. Bigly. I believe that Bigly. I mean, he's, you know, he's from Queens, and I live in Queens, and I can tell you, like, there are certain ways you have to dress or walk in Queens. I actually bought a special hat where I get, you know, fucked with definitely like 63% less, even when I'm wearing something low cut, just because I have a Greek hat on that they don't think they can talk about me that way. So like, I, you know,
but before that,
there were a lot of different words that were flung in my direction in several languages that I didn't learn, but I know the words for tits in a lot of languages now.
What a Greek hat, like how does that ward off boob ogling or catcalling? Like, what is it?
Ogling? No, I didn't say it warned off ogling. It warns off comments.
Okay, but like, what is it?
Ogling, I, you
what
know.
What properties does a hat have
dogs,
that,
you kind know? Of,
how does the hat silence others? I don't know, just.
Well, because I lived in a very Greek neighborhood, so if I look like a Greek lady, there are certain things you don't want to do because she'll come at, like, she'll say some other rude things to you that'll be much ruder. But like, you know, if I just look like average, you know, sort of Irish American girl, they're figuring I won't be nearly as mean. But if I'm wearing a Greek hat, they assume not a lot of Irish American girls have Greek hats.
Okay. So it's like your big,
it's
fat...
it's a complicated way that you have to move through the world as a woman, Jeb. Let's just leave it there.
I understand that there's certain like behaviors that you wind up like involuntarily having to adopt to cope with, like men voluntarily being asinine, but like I was just wondering about the properties of like your, the sort of like Greek haberdashery and whether that warded things. But anyway, so you're going down there. Are you covering it in some way? Are you like forced to go to like these ghostly parties and like the way people visit like dead malls for like urbex?
Thankfully, no. Before Donald Trump announced that he was not doing his first White House Correspondents' Dinner, the comedian Samantha Bee announced that she was going to host a not the White House Correspondents' Dinner just before it, a special edition of her show called Full Frontal with Samantha Bee. And that has actually turned into the celebrity must-have ticket in town for the weekend. And so I am actually going down to cover that. I think Key and Peele are going to be there. There's going to be a whole host of comedians. That's kind of where the celebrities that are in town are apparently planning on going. They're going to highlight the work of small town newspapers and nice. News gatherers of various varieties. Yeah, and all of the money that they're raising from ticket sales and from donations, they're giving to the Committee to Protect Journalists.
Nice.
Which helps advocate for journalists both that fear for their lives and livelihoods. So, I mean, it's a great, you know, it's a great uplifting thing, but it should also be pretty funny because she's basically said she's going to say the word fuck a lot, which, you know, is pretty much all I need to hear to go to a comedy show. So,
you know, this used to be a family podcast. So what I think is funny is like, so Trump is having this rally in, I think, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Yes.
And like
lovely Harrisburg. I've been there.
The theory behind it, I think, for the Trump team is that all the Trump faithful will be like going to the 24-hour news to watch his rally instead of going to C-SPAN to watch the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And and he's going to counter program against it, and his ratings are going to be boffo, and he's going to show everyone. And like, I get why they think that, but what I think is sort of interesting is like, what, I mean, the audience for people who want to watch the White House Correspondents' Dinner as opposed to watch like the best parts of it the next day on, you know, BuzzFeed or Vulture is tiny. And like the audience for people who are going to spend Saturday night, I guess, you know, watching like a Trump rally is vanishingly small. So like, even if it is a victory, it's going to be this sad little victory.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing is that it means a lot of the White House correspondents will be in Harrisburg. So he's actually like fucking them by not showing up for their dinner, which is a scholarship fundraiser, but then he's double fucking them by telling them they can't go to their dinner either, and they all have to go to Harrisburg for the day. Not that Harrisburg isn't a lovely place, shout out to the four people that I know in Harrisburg, but it's kind of like, you know, it's lesser than Albany. I'm just gonna tell you the truth right now. Like, if you don't think Albany is like beautiful and scenic, don't go to Harrisburg.
Listen,
you're not missing that much.
I just want to issue an apology to our large segment of our core audience in upstate New York, especially in Albany. this woman does not represent.
Whatever. I grew up in Scotia, so SDHS represent.
So, do you think that like some of these outlets, you know, CNN, The Post, whatever, are just going to send like the junior staffers out to Harrisburg? Like, it doesn't. I mean, because you know, it's part of the bonus of the dinner has always been kind of like you get a day off because you know where the president's going to be, and he's going to be doing the same mostly insipid thing that you're doing that doesn't really require any reporting. I mean, do you think that they're just going to maintain the tradition as kind of a passive fuck you? Like, you don't get Dave Weigel and Robert Costa from the Post. You get like, you know, some you know, junior intern from the style section who shows up.
I mean, the thing is normally most of the table is actually filled with celebrities. You know, all of these news organizations like invite whomever, you know, ABC, CBS, you know, all of the news stations like that have actually like shows on their entertainment side end up bringing all of their entertainment figures to the event.
Yeah.
So most of the time, even like anybody but the most senior of reporters isn't going to be at the table because their seats are going to be filled by some I don't know. I would say Mob Wife, are those still a thing? I'm terrible with this reality TV stuff.
It's like Bradley Whitford. I don't even know if he has a show, but he just keep, you know, like he's just a mainstay now. It's kind of like the center square.
I kind of think, like, can Bradley Whitford, who just, wasn't he like the creepy father in Get Out? Like, can he really go, like, be a Donald Trump person? Like, I mean, I guess he could go in character, right?
Yeah. I didn't mean like for Trump's thing. I was just talking about like the White House Correspondents' Dinner in general. Like, he gets sort of an emeritus dinner invite because he was Josh Lyman on West Wing. So it's like, just show up, pick a chair, we'll reshuffle. So.
Now, I think what's going to end up happening is all the senior reporters are going to, it's a whole day of events in Harrisburg. It's like two factory tours, man. And then the rally besides, it's the whole day. And it's, you know, it's not an insignificant drive to Harrisburg. It's a couple hours. And if there's traffic, it's a long time up the parkway. So, you know, it's, they're all going to be gone. So I think it's going to be, you know, junior people and business side staff. And, you know, some organizations just gave money to the Correspondents Association and didn't even want the table. So probably what's going to happen is those empty seats are going to be bought by all the lobbyists that want access to whomever is actually there.
All right. So I don't think we can exhaust the White House Correspondents Dinner anymore. So we'll just take a quick one and we'll be right back.
Welcome back, everyone. Jeb's in the can, so we can talk about what's really important, which is sex. Although technically what I want to talk about is birth control, because for those who are not in the United States and don't know, the Affordable Care Act, which is to say Obamacare, made contraception one of the rights that you had access to as a woman. And so it had to be paid for, and it was considered preventative care because it prevents things, and thus was covered without copay. For many women, what this meant was that you had access to birth control for no copay, birth control pills, or implants like Norplant or Depo-Provera, which is shots, or IUDs, which are intrauterine devices. As soon as Trump was elected, many of my friends and colleagues and people that I sort of know acquaintance-wise started to talk about getting intrauterine devices for the first time because they're extremely expensive, but they last for either 1, 3, 5, or 10 years, depending on the device that you get. They're extremely effective, and at least until the Trump administration changed the law, they're free. They are also notably one of the reasons why some religious organizations are contesting the contraception mandate in court. And some of those cases are continuing. Hobby Lobby in particular was concerned about providing IUDs because under their leaders' religious beliefs, an IUD is actually a kind of abortion, which is medically not true, but God and science, you know how that goes. Now, the Trump administration has asked for a delay in yet another case related to birth control access. Responding to it in any way, shape, or form, the intention seems to be to pass a regulation that will eliminate or significantly inhibit women's access to contraception. It's not that funny.
I just got back. What's going on?
Sex.
Right. Carry on. No, my only thing I want to add to this is like I remember, you know, I think it was, I mean, maybe a week after the election when I started seeing almost every woman that I went to high school or college with, so you know, still in like premenopausal age, start openly talking about like, am I going to go and just go get an IUD because if this is not gonna, anyone who wasn't like, you know, hadn't already kind of reckoned with a long-term birth control solution, like making their husband get a vasectomy, or not making, but, you know, asking or figuring that this is like a way more reasonable way of doing things. But like just started doing that public on the Facebook wall kind of discussion of like, when am I going to go do this? How am I going to go do this? Because I need like a financial solution for the next 10 years if I can handle it, or at least 5, like maybe he's a one-termer and we can go back to normal, but I got to get this while the getting's good.
Well, and the thing to think about too is, you know, if your insurance doesn't cover it, it could be $30 a month. It could be $100 a month. You know, every birth control pill is different. Some of them are generics and some are formulated so that they're actually brand name. Some of them work better and some of them don't. You know, when I was on birth control pills for, I guess, 8 years, I had to take 7 different ones because they kept changing my body in different ways. One would give me panic attacks and one would give me migraines and the other gave me a yeast infection, which was really terrible. And you know, you just had to keep changing until you found one that worked with your body chemistry and your cycle and all these things. But you know, once in a while I'd be paying $5 and then I'd be paying $30, and that was, you know, that's a lot. And you can't kind of go on and off of it. So it's not like I can go off of it and then go on a date tomorrow and be like, oh, like maybe I'll have sex with that guy. I should start taking the birth control pill again. It's, you have to basically take it consistently, whether you're having sex or not. Whereas an IUD, you kind of get it installed, which is as fun as it sounds like, but then it's just there for as long as it needs to be there and is still valid. So, you know, for a lot of women, it is a preferred method, but it's also a little scary because, you know, in America has actually one of the lowest acceptance rates of IUDs among the OECD countries because there's just so little education about it. But when you start to look into it, you find $700-$800.
Yeah, even those long-term solutions can have those, like, just like the pill, those not disastrous, but like super inconvenient or painful consequences. Like I remember friends in college who'd get the Depo shot and then they'd have their period for 3 months. And then they would still just randomly get it and it would be more painful than it was when they were on the pill or when they were just using condoms with their partners. Or, you know, there's some the newer IUD, and the one that's not just the copper that actually has a hormone in it.
The Mirena.
Yeah, like one of the side effects of that is like for some women they get, you know, just like really unpleasant discharge. And if you don't want to be saddled with that for 5 years and you want to swap it out for a different IUD, you know, that's like a massive investment. Like if you don't have insurance and you pick the wrong one, you know, that's like a 5-year sentence of like, well, I'm just going to be gross and unhappy with myself because I have no choice.
Or you pay another $300 to go get it yanked out. I mean, and that's just get it yanked out if nothing happens. I mean, some of the risks of them is they can migrate. They can sort of find their way to places they're not supposed to be. And then that's surgery.
Yeah. So that's labor on top of parts. I mean, it's like going to the mechanic.
Exactly. So, you know, it could be the sort of thing like to have an IUD put in without insurance could be $1,000, which, you know, if you are talking about a 10-year IUD and you're amortizing the cost of birth control over 10 years, like that might work out in your favor. You know, I actually, when I got my first one, when I was much younger, I had to pay completely out of pocket. And because even my own gynecologist wasn't that familiar with how the new ones were functioning, I had to sign all of these legal forms where I promised not to sue her if I turned out infertile. And I was like, I'm much more concerned about fertility than I am infertility. Thank you.
How vague was the science that like your gynecologist is like, well, I don't know. I mean, there's a waiver here that says this one could turn you metal. Like,
well, because
you could become Iron Man.
Why? Well, there was actually a kind of IUD in the late 70s and early 80s that was really dangerous for women because it was manufactured and installed incorrectly, essentially, and it caused many women to become infertile, to die, to have, you know, to get like rampaging internal infections. So that's one of the reasons why the acceptance rate here is much lower, is it was really only in the United States that this happened. And so a lot of older gynecologists sort of remember that and didn't know much about how the science and technology had progressed in the intervening 30 years.
That's a weird thing to do when it's your job, though.
That's the worst thing a gynecologist does to you or tells you, like, you're lucky, man. Like, I mean, it's all, you know, it's all a crapshoot when you've got someone, like, pure, you know, I mean, basically you're up in the stirrups and someone's got their face in your snatch and, like, a bunch of lights. You know, you're just sort of at anybody's mercy at that point.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like, I'm, you know, in the 70s, they added like a preservative to Schlitz and then another one to keep it from like going flat. And then they didn't test them together. So it turned Schlitz milky. And it went from being like the number 3 Ooh. Beer in the United States to the number 20 beer in the United States. And it never recovered. And it just seems like being like if you were a brewmaster and that happened, you're like, well, I don't know. I guess beer is bad for you. So I'm going to keep prescribing Bud and I'm never going to read about, I don't know, anything. Like microbrews, they could kill you. Like, just like, it's your fucking job. Like, I mean, do the reading.
Like, things like neuroscience. Like one of the groups of doctors that is most sued by patients is actually obstetricians and gynecologists. So part of the other fun aspect of the American medical system and American legal system is that doctors are sued all the time, whether or not they're actually committing malpractice or could have done anything differently. And so at least, and I guess where I was living at the time in Virginia, like the lawsuits must have been so intense, because I had one gynecologist stop practicing medicine entirely because the malpractice insurance got so high. So it
becomes, that's what happens when you move to a place that's for lovers. I mean,
I don't know how lovely it was, but yeah.
So the DOJ wants to maintain a stay, right? So the Obama administration countersued. Walk us through the court case and where it stands now.
So there's a bunch of religious organizations don't want to have to cover birth control as part of the contraception mandate and want a really expanded, what is sort of known as a provider conscience clause, which basically says you have a religious objection to reproductive rights, and so you get to do whatever the fuck you want. And the Obama administration was fighting them. The case, you know, essentially was wending its way through the courts. And now the Trump administration has asked for a stay so that they have more time to consider. But mostly at this stage of the case, the expectation among observers is that they're actually just going to issue an executive order or promulgate a new regulation that they expect will solve the plaintiff's issues, but probably screw women.
Huh. So there's no chance that they don't want to fight this because they don't want to open the door too much to religious exemptions, because I've been sort of wondering if at some point.
No, they're so, with these provider conscience clauses, that, you know, these are the same kind of laws that they're trying to use to allow, you know, bakers to refuse service to gay people, and to allow people, I guess, to beat up transgender people trying to use the bathroom. I mean, whatever. These kinds of laws, you know, that are sort of, which were promulgated a lot in the 90s and were very often thrown out by the Supreme Court because they were overly broad. They just kind of love these laws because they can say it's about preserving religion and whatever, when really it's about sort of mandating other people, like your employees or gay people in a relation to you, abide by your religious beliefs as opposed to freedom from religion. But
yeah, I remember the originating law for that was it was about certain, you know, like American Native American tribes using peyote for their ceremonies, and the religious exemption was to get around federal scheduling, like narcotic scheduling and criminalization of peyote. And then, you know, everybody sort of thought like, well, it's very sensitive in Mr. Clinton, right? It was Bill.
Yeah, it was Clinton.
In like 93 or 94, right? Yeah. And then, of course, that was like the wonderful Trojan horse for the religious right, because if you can exempt it for Native Americans, then, you know, what about like traditional white folk ways, like not letting you have birth control?
Right. And that does seem like a traditional white folk way, doesn't it?
It does.
I mean, I think, I all these laws have been, you know, and attempts at these kinds of laws broadly have been around for a long time. I mean, George, it was one of the last things that actually George W. Bush rammed through was a provider conscience clause related to abortion and not birth control. But, you know, I mean, you have these all over the place. So if you get a Plan B prescription because, you know, you made a mistake with your birth control regimen or something, and you go to, when you had to used to get a prescription, went to Walmart, the cashier at Walmart could refuse to check you out. You know, pharmacists could refuse to give it to you because they had a religious exemption, and they said they didn't think what you were doing is right, so you don't have access to something.
Well, I can't see why Walmart would steer you wrong.
Yes, Walmart is everything that is good about America.
There's a 24-hour Walmart maybe like 3 miles from my house. So I say we wrap this up and I'm going to go shop for a rifle.
I mean, make sure you get bullets.
Mainly it's the rifle. I just want to strap that on and just wander around going like, I'm not intimidating you. It's free speech at like a Chipotle.
I think you need to come up with a new restaurant because you need to be more creative. I think you need to go someplace more like Chuck E. Cheese.
But like if I go in there without a kid, it'll be creepy. I mean, if I go in there with a gun, that'll be normal.
I mean, that does seem about right for some places in America.
It does. All right. Seriously, like I think we should go and like leave immediately and buy guns. Does that sound good?
Well, I'm in New York, so I'm just going to go buy like liquor and weed or something.
All right. That sounds like a plan. Thank you so much for being on, Megan. And is there any place that people can find you if you want to be found?
MeganCarpentier.com.
Right on. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks for listening, folks. Thanks too to Chris Collingwood of Fountains of Wayne for providing the music this week. Technically, he provided it for my other podcast, This Week in Atrocity, but I choose to beg for forgiveness rather than seek permission. You could also mollify an outraged Chris by going to Amazon.com and picking up a copy of his solo album, Look Park. Hopefully, Tim will return soon from his trip into the heart of darkness. In the meantime, you can catch his other podcast, The Worst Idea of All Time. You can also listen to mine. Or you can hear me this week on The Daily Beast's conspiracy theory podcast, Truther. Talk to you soon.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.